Box to Box Stoppage Time.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Great savings every day.
And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices.
Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Hello and welcome to Box Stoppage Time, a show where we wrap the week in world football through our personal favourite or most notable games, teams and hot topics. Rob Gilbert is resting up after a long Easter Monday on the golf course, so you're with Willem van Denderen, Derek Dyson and Michael Edgley. Derek at the Hillsville Sanctuary has the new ball as usual. You've been in rare touch of late, Derek, on Stoppage Time. Stats, movie references, history lessons. Look forward to what you've got up your sleeve today. Game of the week, please.
I'm looking forward to hearing Rob Gilbert's score in the golf, actually. Hasn't mentioned it yet, so that's not a good sign. Usually if you have a good round, you tell people about it. Screen grab the scorecard and all that, so I wonder. But going to what you originally asked me, Willem, game of the week. Could have picked many in the Premier League this weekend. There were 32 goals across the 10 matches. I just went for Sheffield United-Fulham, which ended 3-3. I just thought that this one was packed with narrative. Gives me a chance to talk about the bottom end of the league as well, with so much emphasis on the top half of the league this weekend. It was an amazing game. Fulham were 3-1 down to Sheffield United. Would have been a vital victory for them. And once again, Sheffield United threw it away in the third of 14-14, 1-4 scheduled added minutes. Munez connected with an amazing cross from Adama Traore for a bicycle kick, whatever you want to call it, send those Fulham fans behind the goal into dreamland, really, to snatch that point. And for the poor old Blades, that leaves them 7 points behind Forest in 17th and Luton in 18th. So they're still marooned. But Wilder, again, will be reflecting on a case of points dropped from a winning position. It could be so different if they just managed to hold on in a couple of these games. They've only scored 24 goals in 28 matches, but managed three in this one. But unfortunately for them, they've conceded 24 goals in their past five home games, which probably tells you the story. Meanwhile, for Fulham, they're sitting in 12th, but they do have an outside chance of reaching the Europa Conference League. Seventh this year in the Premier League will potentially get you into Europe. It all depends on what happens in the FA Cup. But they're 5 points behind West Ham at the moment. They'll also be wondering how they didn't win this game. But it was just another bonkers Premier League game. And I don't know the stats, but I'd hesitate. You know, I'd probably say that, you know, the games, there's just been more goals. There's been more goals in the Premier League this season. I don't know if that's better attacking or worse defending, but another classic at Bramall Lane this time.
Nice one, Edge. We'll come domestically as we welcome you in with some A-League women's, or it was, a seismic game that has defined the end of the season from the league perspective, and will do so as we head into the finals this week.
Well, the Sydney FC Melbourne Victory A-League women's contests are always the biggest grudge match of the year. They've played off in so many finals matches and so many big matches that the rivalry is very unique. They're two probably statistically the best coaches in the competition, Ante Juric and Jeff Hopkins, go head-to-head, and they're always enthralling encounters. This had some incredible backstories to it as well in terms of the pressure on Melbourne Victory, who have a squad really that should see them much higher on the ladder and probably challenging for the Premier's plate. But they needed to win this match to draw to ensure themselves a finals place after they sat back and watched all the results unfold over the weekend. So the pressure would have been mounting on them. And Sydney FC, after losing midweek to Canberra in Canberra, which was a shock result, they needed to win to ensure that they could win their fourth Premier's plate in a row, which would have been a remarkable achievement for Ante Juric. So a lot to play for. Sydney absolutely capitulated here. It was an incredible day's activities. Interesting to note that Jeff Hopkins brought two of his young Matildas who were missing over the last month because of were representing Australia at the Under-20 Women's World Cup. He brought Alana Murphy in as the number six, and Jessica Nash replaced Emma Checker. They made big impacts on the match. And the big talking point wasn't so much the four goals that Melbourne Victory scored. It was the non-red card for Yada Wyman, who lashed out and kicked Alex Chidiak. She was given a yellow card and conceded a penalty. The referee made an obvious error. Had she been given a red card, Yada Wyman probably would have missed both semi-finals for Sydney FC. So she can count herself very, very lucky, as I understand it, because the referee gave a yellow card on the field. It can't be reviewed by the disciplinary committee after the match. So Yada Wyman, I don't know if you saw it, Willem, but it was just a brain fade of epic proportions. She's launched out and kicked Alex Chidiak and conceded a penalty. At that stage, they went 2-0 behind, and you know, from that point on, they were chasing the game.
Yeah, it was as red as the day is long. And I guess what sort of needs to be said is she had the ball in her hands as the goalkeeper. So the play, while it wasn't stopped, it was effectively, you know, completely in her control. And as Alex Chidiak got up in front of her, she just kicked her straight out. So I don't know how that could possibly how there could be any grey area between yellow and red. It was a non-football act, wasn't in the play.
Yeah, it's an obvious error from the referee, and I think a major talking point, which may shape the championship of this competition. So yeah, very interesting. And and I just might add my last comment on this before I throw back to you is that there was over 4,500 people at that game. The A-League women's crowds have been fantastic. In fact, every match. The last four matches in the A-League's women's all have drawn better than the last five Western United A-League men's home gates. So the A-League women's, it's on the move. Really good crowds.
Nice. My game of the week comes from the A-League men's, also involving Sydney FC. It was their match against the Mariners. Huge game in many contexts. We spoke to Mark Jackson about how Sydney smashed the Mariners, his side, inside 20 minutes the last time they played with their press and heading into Saturday night. That game was the Mariners' only loss in 23 games all competitions. So how would the Mariners deal with Sydney FC's Red Bull-style press? They did it by letting Sydney FC have the ball, and that was all well and good until Sydney started scoring goals themselves. So 2-0 they did them was the end scoreline. Mariners had just one shot on target. They were nowhere near the side that we've seen over the past 6 months at least and beyond. Anthony Caceres' edge, one that you called for a little bit more from a while back now, was very good. Joe Lolly and Ryan Grant did as they pleased, and Joel King scored his first goal at the level. So they're now just a point away from a home final. By the time you hear this, we'll have had another look at the Mariners. They play City on Tuesday night before they then play Wellington in a genuine six-pointer on Saturday. But that was pretty emphatic from Sydney FC. Lots of things you could look into. Mariners have had a huge run of fixtures and they've managed them really well. But on this occasion, they were pretty flat. Sydney had a lot of the ball, and that may well have been by design. But yeah, they were nowhere near it here, the Mariners. And as we've been talking about Edge, the Sky Blues just have that bullet next to their name. They are coming like a train.
Yes, Rob Gilbert's doppelganger, Ufuk Tele. Ever since he got there, they have well and truly turned it around. And they were very impressive on the weekend. I know that you said the Central Coast looked like they were a bit flat, but I thought they were super impressive the way they retained possession and really squeezed that game.
Derek, back to you for the team of the week, please.
Thanks, Willem. As the rain starts pounding down here in Hillsville, if anyone's wondering for background noise. Team of the week for me was quite simple. We mentioned it off the top of the main show. Bayer Leverkusen, it is going to happen now, isn't it? Leverkusen no more. It would take quite the implosion from here for them not to become Bundesliga champions. For the first time, they beat Hoffenheim 2-1 at the weekend. Once again, they found themselves behind the Bundesliga game. Once again, they managed to come back and they extended their unbeaten streak to 38 games. And they did it with 5 minutes of the game remaining, essentially, to send that what looks like an amazing crowd just going absolutely berserk there at the stadium. And it was chic. With the razor sharp finish at the end there to get the job done. They're now 13 points clear of Bayern Munich, who of course lost Der Klassiker to Dortmund 2-0 at home. Harry Kane coming back from injury, not being able to deliver the goods in that particular game. So there were seven games to go. So that's 21 points, 13 clear. As I said, more or less impossible now for Bayern to win the league. And of course, as we mentioned in the main show, it's the week that Xabi Alonso announced he was going to stay, which is, I suppose, all rather arrogantly, I suppose, in the media. We all just assumed that he would move on, but he's chosen to stay. That's really put a spoke in the wheel of Liverpool's managerial appointment plans. De Zerbi is in the frame. There's a guy called Ruben Amorim, who is currently the manager of Sporting Lisbon, apparently well-liked. Bayern, well, their plans are completely buggered now. I don't know who they're going to appoint. Some word, Emery might be offered the job. But fair play to Xabi Alonso. My read is that he's a very young man. He's got a very long career ahead of him. He's onto a really good thing in Leverkusen. And I think, why would you just jump off this ship now? You know, just take this as far as you can possibly take it. The Barcelona, Real Madrid, all of that, Liverpool, that'll all wait. That is all ahead of him. But for now, he's showing incredible loyalty. And you don't often get that, gents, in the modern game. He's gone up a notch further in my estimation, old Xabi.
Such a minefield, isn't it, Edge, these top jobs. So as Derek says, onto a good thing. Hang about. Win it twice if you can. Doesn't look like Bayern are going to turn it around anytime soon, considering those just sort of lurch from issue to issue over the past year or so. So I think it seems a pretty sound decision.
Yeah, it does. And it just proves that you've got to be a special person to take on a big brand like a Liverpool. You know, it's such a high-pressure environment, isn't it? Maybe Xavi should have taken a little bit of a leaf out of Pep Guardiola's book, Willem. I noticed on the weekend you and I were, as the boys were sleeping in Melbourne, I was in Bangkok watching Arsenal and Manchester City, and you were in Amsterdam doing the same. And I couldn't help notice that Pep and Lolly, his assistant, they do things NPL Melbourne style, don't they? They just had the scruffy jeans, the dirty runners, and a coat that looked like he'd worn about 50 times. And Lolly was wearing a T-shirt over a wind cheater, which I couldn't even read it. It wasn't even... So they weren't wearing club attire at all. They were just like they had a cup of coffee on a Sunday morning and just lobbed in to coach their NPL team on the weekend. It's amazing that the bloke arguably coaching one of the wealthiest clubs in the world can just get away with that. It's just extraordinary. No Melbourne City gear at all. His jeans, I think he's worn those pair of jeans in every match in the last 3 years, Derek, Pep Guardiola. He does it, as I would say, NPL style Melbourne.
Oh, I think his attire is a disgrace, to be honest with you. I don't think he should be allowed into the ground. You know, think of the, you know, Arsene Wenger, you know, Alex Ferguson. Yeah, I think you can go a little bit smarter than that.
Gareth Southgate.
Where's
the double-breasted suit?
Three-piece up, yeah.
And Pep and Lolly was wearing a T-shirt, looked like it was about 100 years old.
Where's the class gone out of the game, honestly?
What about Tony Gustafsson with the white long sleeve and the Matilda scarf?
Yeah, that was not good. That was not
good.
You look like something out of ABBA when they played Canada. Australia played Canada at Sydney, at Allianz Stadium, I should say, that friendly match. He wore an all-white outfit, Tony Gustafsson. I hope someone had a word to him.
That's a Swedish thing. Edge, staying in England for your team of the week?
Well, I'm going to go to the Arsenal women's team because they've had a terribly inconsistent season. Despite some massive home crowds at the Emirates, which has been a real reward for Arsenal's one club strategy, which a lot of the English Premier League clubs are now mimicking, the one club strategy. Despite that, they'd had an up and down season. So they went into the League Cup final not as favourites. Chelsea had absolutely given them a bath 2 weeks earlier. So it was a remarkable result for the Arsenal women, and all of the Australians had a big hand in the result. Caitlin Ford, Cara Kuniakoski and Steph Catley. So it really was Arsenal's only chance to end this season with some sort of silverware, and they got the job done. And it was a very emotional sort of end of the game. The Arsenal head coach, Jonas Edvall, said that one of the learnings from the league match against Chelsea was that they didn't cope well in a high-pressure, stressed environment, and they focused on that during the week and were able to right things. And he said they spent a lot of time planning for that. It was an important lesson in that league game, and they want to be a high-performing team, and they want to embrace those high-pressure situations. Well, they certainly did in the Continental Cup final. So Arsenal, they entered 2023 with big ambitions. They've failed at the qualifying stage of the Champions League. They've been off the pace in the Women's Super League. And Derek, but they get the League Cup. So all of a sudden, the League Cup in both competitions, the Premier League and the Women's Super League, it's often only important if it's the only thing you can win. So for the Arsenal women's team, congratulations, they're my team of the week. And they get the League Cup, and they can celebrate the Cup because it's the only thing they can win.
Oh, absolutely. This is the bare minimum they needed from this season, as you said. They have hired really astutely this season. They've got a fantastic roster of players. They're going out of the Champions League against Paris FC. It was a disaster. And yeah, look, I think they lost their opening game to Liverpool at home in the Premier League, or the equivalent, the WSL. And they never really recovered from it. So, I think Man City and Chelsea, whoever wins out of those two, will be deserved champions. And Arsenal have just got to, you know, use this cup as momentum for next season.
My team of the week is the national team of Georgia. They've reached the Euros for the first time at the eighth attempt since they gained their independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. They did it in a pretty sneaky manner. They finished fourth out of five in their qualifying group. Their only two wins came against Cyprus, who were beaten by everybody. So that saw Spain and Scotland progress, and Norway finished third. But it was the fourth place Georgians who advanced into the playoffs due to their Nations League form. So there you go. That Nations League does matter after all. They rolled Luxembourg comfortably, 2-0, thanks to a brace from Boudou Zivzivadze. And that set up a do-or-die meeting with Greece. Greece have their own storied history in the competition, of course. Ask anyone around Melbourne and they'll tell you that they won it in 2004. But they were looking to return for the first time since 2012. Some fisticuffs at halftime saw Georgia's reserve keeper red-carded from the bench. So they had a red card, but still had 11 on the field. Ultimately, their main keeper was enough in the shootout, though. Georgi Mamardashvili, some great names, as they won 4-2, sparking a pitch invasion in Tbilisi. Their star, of course, as we know, is Kvaratskhelia of Napoli. He's a gun. He deserves to be on the Euro stage. Edge, did you want to dip into a quiz on the three Georgian players to play in the A-League, or did you want me to give you the names?
He can give me the name.
Yeah, I thought that might be stretching it a little bit. Beka Mikkeltadze, of course, for the Newcastle Jets. He was good. Beka Dartsmelia, who had a top name as well, but wasn't quite as good for the Newcastle Jets. And then Bukana Arabuli, who played for MacArthur last season. So that sees Georgia, or the Giovannos Nebi, the Crusaders, slide into a Euros group of Portugal, the Czech Republic, and Turkey. So well done to Georgia.
Willem, do you know who the Georgia manager is?
I did see the name and I recalled it somewhat, but go on.
Willy Sagnol, the ex-French international right-back. So what a way to kick-start your managerial career in Georgia. And it's not the only slightly random manager of an Eastern European football team. Albania's national football team is managed by ex-Arsenal, Man City and Barcelona player Silvinho. So there you go.
My great Georgian story is Ned Zelic told me when, at the end of his career, when Dinamo Tbilisi qualified for the European Champions League, one of Ned's former teammates in one of his German clubs was their coach and rang him up and said, look, I need an old hand to come and play. Would you consider it? The president's willing to entertain it. Ned said, okay, fair enough. I'll go and talk to the president. Ned got on a plane, went there, met the president, went out for 3 days in a row, didn't sleep, signed his contract on the third day and played for a season in Tbilisi. He went from playing Borussia Dortmund at the Yellow Wall, to a league match in a paddock with cows on the fence the next day.
Not bad. I remember you taking me to a Georgian restaurant, Edge, probably a week after we'd met in Russia.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it? I mean, the Georgian food. Fantastic. Yeah, very different than Russian food, the Georgian food. They have the fantastic bread with the egg in the middle. I'm sure we had some of that, Willem, with some cheese. But no, very good food, Georgian food.
Now, there aren't many dinners that you remember 7 years on. That is one that certainly sticks in the mind. Derek, your hot topic, please.
Yeah, just a bit of like fun for me at the end here. I've been taken in a little bit by the Kia Ute campaign that's going on here at the moment. And you guys, I've got the wrong audience here. You're both away from Australia, but are you aware of the Kia naming the new Ute campaign?
Nope.
I can tell you then. So there's some ads going on at the moment where basically Kia are teasing that they're bringing this new Ute into the market. Kia have never had a Ute before. And there's an opportunity to name it after a iconic Australian sports person. And the ads going around at the moment have John Aloisi in it. And they also have Mackenzie Arnold in them as well. So it's I think it's quite a bit of fun and quite a good idea, actually, that it to put a spoiler on it, it will actually be called the Kia Tasman. And that's been sort of hinted at in the adverts. But everyone from Ash Bartley to Dylan Alcott to Kerry O'Keefe, Wendell Saylor have all been part of this campaign. The Kia Sailor, yeah. So I was thinking, if we were going to make it part of soccer or football, what would we do? So you could have the Kia Viduka. I thought Kia Postecoglou, the Kia Polkinghorne.
It'd have to be the Kia Warren, wouldn't it? Captain Kia Johnny Warren. Or the Kia, I told you so.
The Kia Warren, yeah. Come on, that. Rolls off the tongue.
I've got one for you, Derek, because you might – the Subaru once bought out a ute. Do you remember what it was called? It might have been before your time. I can see Adam's probably nodding. But do you remember that Subaru called it the Brumby? Do you remember that?
The Brumby. That's a pretty good name for it. That's a pretty good name for a U. I actually think it's a real shame they're not going to call it after a sports star when I realised that they'd already named it. I mean, it's still a very clever campaign, but I think that would have been great having a, the Kia Aloisi. I would have gone for that. That sounds pretty good, but. Yeah, not sure about the Kia Polkinghorne or the Kia Cahill. Probably a bridge too far.
I love it, the Kia Warren. That's good. That's good gear. Edge, your hot topic.
My hot topic is the Western United A-League Women's team. They will host Newcastle Jets, I believe, on the 13th of April at the Tarnit Regional Football Facility. Now, I know how important Western United's home venue is. It's extremely important that they develop that and it becomes a fortress and a real iconic part of their brand makeup. But at the moment, Willem, it's not ready. And it's got no shade, poor spectator facilities. They're charging $20 to park your car in a dust bowl paddock. Yes, the facilities for the players are good, but this is not worthy of an A-League women's finals match. And had this match been drawn at, say, a Lakeside Stadium, which is a great venue for something like this, it's likely to get 3 to 4 to 5 times the amount of people that will go to Tarnit to watch this game. I know Western United have earned the right for the home match, but I think this is just a little bit selfish from them. It's a really great opportunity to ride the crest of the wave of women's football, fixture it in the centre of town where a venue easily accessible from everyone, get as many people as the game as possible to celebrate rather than, having it, 45 kilometres from the centre of town. So I'm just, that's my hot topic. I think Western United, you could have done better. I know it's important. I know you're very proud of what you're going to build and what you've got there at the moment. But on this occasion, I think you've made the wrong call. And don't charge $20 for people to park the car. That's not on.
Yeah, I think I disagree, but I understand what you're saying. People have been so critical of them for not playing in the West, and now they can. And you're right, it's not ready. But I think they're going to build a history there, they've got to play at their home ground.
Yeah, they're playing the Newcastle Jets. It's going to be a fabulous game. You know, Newcastle Jets have got arguably Victoria's best ever women's footballer in the A-League, women's at the competition at the moment, Melina Ayres. For me, they would have got, had it been in the centre of town, there's a lot of neutrals that would have gone to make it an epic event. They could have got 5,000 or 6,000 people. And I just think that they're not going to do it out there. And the facility is not ready to host big matches at the moment. It's not ready. And I know why they want to do it, and I'm supportive of that. If it was a league game, it's a different story. I just think this is a final. It's a great opportunity to showcase the sport. And, you know, and even Melbourne Victory playing the game at the home of the Matildas, which, again, is not conducive to a large crowd. I'm just disappointed because these fixtures should be drawing big crowds, and they can. You know, both of these games are going to be held on the outskirts of Melbourne when, you know, I'm not sure it's worthy of the matches. But in particular, the Western United one, it's you know, they're doing their best, but it's not ready.
Is it going to be called Ironbark Fields?
I'm not sure.
I think it might be. That'd be an awesome name. I would like to see one big tree planted each game. At least make it feel like there's some sort of progress, Edge, because it is a dust bowl. Absolutely looks like a mining site.
Yeah, it does. You know, look, you know, it's a construction site at the moment, you know, but they're doing their best, and I understand why they're doing it. I'm just think that they've lost an opportunity to do something a bit better this time.
My hot topic, just to close, is players getting it done at the start and the end of their careers. Death story, Iron Kunda, the youngest A-League hat-trick scorer. He's been a little bit down in the dumps at times this season, but he was back to his best against Western United and took that game away from them single-handedly. A hat-trick with a goal in the first half and then two early in the second. And then Michelle Heyman, the first three-time A-League Women's Gold Boot winner in 2009 and 2011-12. And then in season 23-24, her total of 17 goals was the highest ever. But of course, they did play more games, but she did it pretty emphatically, finishing five clear of Sophie Harding, Rachel Lowe, and Serena Bolden. Brings us to the end of Stoppage Time for another week. Thank you for your company, Derek.
Thanks, Dan. See you next time.
Thank you, Edge.
Thanks, Willem and Derek. Enjoy your week's football ahead.
Yeah, A-League Women's Finals going to be large, and Adam Maloney on the buttons for making us sound good. Thank you as well, sir. A reminder, you can get in touch on Facebook, on Twitter, or through the website at boxtobox.com. Rob Gilbert will be back to host the main show on Monday. Please join us then. And until then, enjoy your football. We will be back to go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.